Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. And in this episode, we'll be discussing what happened at Comic-Con 2023, reviews of Talk to Me, Sympathy for the Devil with Nicolas Cage back again. And of course, Barbieheimer, our reviews of Barbie and Oppenheimer. And why can't some guys just be happy for its success? Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me today are my fellow hosts, John Davenport.
Hey, man. How you doing today?
Wonderful. Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello. John, do you feel better that he put you first this time?
No. Now I feel like he's just,
trying to... It's totally like, pity.
Yeah,
it's
totally that's exactly. Pity.
And Troy Heinrichs, who has no problem going last because it's never
that's
least.
That's right. Because I just sit here and make sure nobody sends Aaron emails because he mispronounces things all the time. It's Barbenheimer. Not Barbieheimer. Get the hashtag right.
You know what? It's whatever I said. That's what it is. It's my opening. I will freaking say it how I want.
He almost said it's my podcast.
He sure did.
Like
he
sure did.
He's like, I edit this bitch. I make the format. Y'all are here and I tell you what to say.
Somebody could have mentioned this like yesterday.
Right.
That's all right.
We're also going to be discussing about what didn't happen at Comic-Con 2023.
Yeah,
because not much.
Eek. Poor festival. But you know what? What I saw outside of Hall H was really sad. A lot of people were still going through and having a great time. Kyle Nolan, who's been on many, many episodes, man, he had lots of great pictures and videos from his experiences there.
Because you can still, market movies and television without having the actual people there to market movies and television, which I think is going to be something we can talk about maybe next week. On why SAG and WAG are going to go on forever because the studios aren't actually hurting by people not being around.
We're going to talk about SAG and WGA. Would you really call it WAG if it's WGA? That's well good.
It just sounds cool.
Don't
it just sounds cooler
that.
When it's like SAG and WAG.
That's
it's a saggy WAG.
Oh, it's getting worse.
It is.
It's his drag name at this point.
Yeah.
That was really funny, actually.
It was.
Good job, John.
Thanks. Love to see Troy reading books to kids and bitching at them for reading and comprehending at 2x speed. You remember, you can always find more information at thehollywoodoutsider.com, thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's our website. And remember, it's the last week where you can vote for us for the podcast awards for best in entertainment. That's the category we're in. And also you can vote for the Blacklist Exposed for best in TV and film and People's Choice, the Hollywood Outsider as well. You can vote for us in two categories, best entertainment and People's Choice. And also, I just want to remind people, you can vote with as many emails as you want. And there's a little box you can check to also be a finalist voter. And you can do that. And you can like double down. Help us twice. It's up to you.
Are you really proposing that they cheat in some fashion?
It's not cheating. It's an option. It's an option. It's in the rules.
Yeah. All right.
You can basically mark yourself to be like, I want to be a finalist judge.
Mm-hmm.
No. I'm talking about the multiple emails thing.
That's not cheating
either.
Sign
up with every email you have.
Yes, every email you have.
Every email you have.
Why not? People do it to try to win things. This is like...
this is also a thing we're trying to win, is what he's saying. That's funny.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Podcastawards.com. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about SAG and WGA. The strike continues.
Does it sound the same when you do it that way?
No. WGA? Well, Saggy Wag doesn't really sound like it's an important endeavor. And outside of John just looking at the positives of being able to catch up on content, for a lot of people, it really does affect their livelihood. We haven't really talked about it. So I want to be fair, like open with this. So here's what it is. If you don't know what Screen Actors Guild, Writers Guild of America, Screen Actors Guild of the Actors, Writers Guild of America are the writers. They're both on strike because they want Hollywood to give up the cash. And here's what the problem is. For years, there have been residuals that actors and writers get based on the work that they perform. And with streaming, it's changed a lot. Services like Netflix, Hulu, and Max, they've kind of changed the nature of actors' pay and how residuals work. In addition to facing declining residuals and wages that haven't really kept up with inflation, like I think most companies would say most employees would claim across the country, actors can no longer rely on those royalty payments that are contingent on the amount of a show's reruns, because there aren't really reruns anymore. They're all streaming. And they have complicated job opportunities. Since many shows now have shortened seasons over long periods of time, actors argue that they have less work available to them, even though there's an excessive amount of shows being produced. And then there's the concerns over the unregulated use of AI, which may reproduce an actor's likeness or performance. That's also been a point of contention at the bargaining table. And the Screen Actors Guild members are demanding guarantees on how exactly AI will be deployed by studio and production companies. But the studios aren't budging. They're not budging at all. Now, I want to preface. I reached out to many actors I've talked to over the years, and nobody wanted to go on the record to have an actual interview on this. I assume it's probably because they don't want to speak for the guild, and the guild didn't reply to my emails either. I can't. So we're just going to have to speak as informed as we can.
Well, and they probably couldn't speak currently.
They might not be able to.
That would be considering crossing the line, potentially.
Sure. It's possible. And I'm sure many actors just don't want to get in the middle of it because they're trying to get work. You know, they're worried about health benefits. They're worried about their pay scale. Now, I want to play devil's advocate. I think that's a fair way to look at it, because there are many people who are like, oh, Hollywood, Jesus, you guys, enough with the poor you. You guys are making millions, da, 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 da. Most actors don't. There are tens of thousands of actors, 60-some thousand, 68, I think, thousand members of the Screen Actors Guild. They're not all making big money. And other people will say that when it comes to when you perform a job for a company, you get paid. No other real job except for entertainment do you get residuals, right? Most companies you don't get that. I would argue you do get a bonus, but you know, the idea being that entertainment is different because your likeness is being flashed out there for years and decades to come, and they deserve to get paid for it is how they look at that. I think I can see either way, you know, why someone would look at that a different way. But what do you guys think about this whole guild? I'll go to you first, Troy, just because I know you know television pretty well and how that works in terms of residuals on reruns. I know we all do, but I'm just your TV maverick.
Writers and screen actors, I think, are two different points of contention. I'll take the screen actor side first, right? If you equate it to like what we do for work, right? We show up, we do our job, we go home. I get paid for when I show up and I do my job and I go home. I don't get paid because I put in some technology system that's going to run for the next 20 years. I don't get a kickback every year that system stays in place, right? Just like if I sell a cell phone contract or internet bandwidth, right, for a 3 or 5 year deal, I'm getting paid on the entire deal up front. I'm not getting a commission check every month for the next 5 years of that deal. So I'm not a big fan of the residual side of things. You get paid what you're worth because you're there to basically sell the initial push of the show. So you should be getting more money up front. So I agree that they should strike to get more money up front. I think that's a fair statement. I think the writers are severely underpaid, especially with the fact that they're moving to less episodes. So just because you're doing a 10-episode season versus a 22-episode season, one would say that the 10-episode season is actually better and more focused content and higher quality writing because of that. So we should get paid more because they're delivering more shows because there's less episodes to write of one show. They can work on multiple shows at the same time. So that's all being said on, you know, it's hard because it's like even like in music, right? If I'm an artist and I sing a song, that song could play for eons, right? We still listen to songs from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And those estates are getting paid out on every time it plays, you know, a penny a play or whatever it would end up being on the streaming side. So I think there's got to be a new way to look at residuals that makes sense. The AI likeness thing, I thought that the AI thing was like figured out with, oh my gosh, what's his name that played George McFly? Because there was a whole lawsuit around him with Back to the Future 2 and why he wasn't in the movie in the first place.
Well, they can't do it without their permission. But I think they're concerned down the road because of the way streaming contracts work. They're written differently, so they kind of retain their rights and whatnot. So I think it's a broader stroke. That's what I'm saying.
So I mean, yeah, they shouldn't use their likeness without their permission. Period, AI or otherwise. which I thought was covered by the George McFly incident in Back to the Future 2.
Crispin Glover.
Thank you.
Yeah, and they used him without his permission.
The reason why they're striking, fair, right? The studios do make a crap ton of money. They're going to make more money now because they don't have to pay for enormous amounts of marketing budget. So there's really no incentive for the studios to come to the table. Plus, they're all on vacation anyway until Labor Day. So none of this is going to move very quickly.
I definitely think that if we're going to maintain the residuals program, that they should be able to partake in that. And the reason I'm not so opposed to residuals, I do think that there's merit and you get paid for what you're worth. But as, you know, if something releases and then it grows to be a cult classic and it develops all of that revenue that you no longer have access to, even though you're part of the reason why it is, why should it be so unfairly distributed where certain people would get that profit, but the participants, whether it be the writers or the actors, don't get any of that? That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I mean, if you go to most other jobs, and this is where I'm playing devil's advocate. This isn't how I feel. I'm just saying, taking it, looking at it from a devil's advocate perspective. And this is, I think, why they don't get as much empathy from Joe Public as they would like, is because Joe Public can work. You can work on software, right? You can be the person that developed that software for a company that you work for. They retain the rights to sell that software. They make millions off it. You get nothing but whatever your salary was, and maybe a bonus. And that's right, it.
Because the IP belongs to the company. Yes. The IP doesn't belong to you.
Exactly. All right, how that works. I mean, that's devil's advocate. That is fair.
Right.
From a company standpoint.
I mean, you're taking like the lowest common denominator, because when you're
speaking
taking
about take a look, most businesses in America,
right? But if you're looking at account, you know, financial advisors, insurance salespeople, people who become the face of the product, salespeople in general, there are sales structures in which there is a long tail factor built into it. So there is a sales structure, or there is a structure where you become the person that is managing accounts. You're the reason why people keep showing up, and you get residuals off of those sales you made, or those accounts you create, or any of those things, as far as a sales structure is concerned.
Actively manage is the key word. My financial advisor gets paid because he's actively managing my accounts, and he only makes money if I make money. So if you want to equate it to rest of America and bonuses, then you can say, hey, if this stays on the streaming service for 1 year, you get a kicker, or 2 years, you get a kicker, or it makes a certain threshold, you get a kicker at the box office.
Who's to say that an actor's face is what isn't what brings people to a TV show? An actor's shows up. I mean, we always talk about how actors have to show up and do these press junkets. They have to do these interactions. So they're selling a product. Mm-hmm. And the actors become responsible for selling a product, and they should be able to receive in whatever degree in which they're selling that product. So David Harbour should get more money out of Stranger Things than maybe Carla, what's her face, the one who plays Mike's mom. Anyhow, because she's no Mike's mom.
Mike's mom.
Carla Bruno.
Yeah.
She's only in a couple of episodes. She shouldn't be making the same kind of residual money as David Harbour is, because David Harbour's the main attraction. So, or one of the main attractions. So that's if you look at it as a sales structure, because these people have to show up and they have to put their lives on pause to sell a product, even after they're done being a part of it, then they have a right to some sort of structure like that.
I had the number wrong. It's more than 160,000. So that are in SAG-AFTRA.
They're in SAG.
Yeah.
Let me put it another way. I'm a bus driver, because I actually did this. I'm a bus driver.
You drove children?
I drove children and I drove football teams. So the football team, I got paid for driving the football team from point A to point B, flat amount, right? My job is to get them there and get them back. But because it's like 400 miles away from where a starting point was, I also got paid per hour I had to sit there and wait for the thing to be done in order for them to come back. So it's two different pay like structures.
Like detention. Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah. In that case, like you get paid David Harbour for the movie for what you've done. You might get certain bonus thresholds depending how the movie does, but we'll also pay you X salary per event that you help promote the movie. You get 10% of whatever the PR budget is because you did 10 talk shows and whatever. So you could still get paid for the work that you do because promoting the movie for Joe and Jane America is going to be under that part of the job description that says, and other job duties as required.
Yeah, I'm not arguing.
Playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't give a shit about the devil or the advocate. I'm just saying that. I'm just saying that you guys are saying that, like, you know, basic America. Yeah, you're right. I don't get paid any extra for showing up and doing my job. When I go home, I stop essentially getting paid.
Even if my work is being used for years and years to come.
Yeah. You know what? As an artist, if I sit there and I put a piece of artwork on the internet so that it can be bought, all I have to do is make that piece of artwork once and people keep buying it. That's essentially the same thing as the residuals. Like
here's what I will say. I don't think that's necessarily true. If the studio is paying for it, how can you really say, even if you wrote it, if you designed something and you sold it to Disney and they sell it, that's Disney's property, no longer yours, right? Is that not correct?
Depending on the terms of the sale. Yeah.
It depends on the terms of how I sell it to Disney. It's if I sell it to Disney. So, okay, here's if we're going to take it down the art road. There's an artist here that I know. His name is Don Mates. Don Mates is a very famous artist when it comes to Dungeons and Dragons, a lot of fantasy stuff. He is responsible for the design of Captain Morgan. Right. He's the one who designed Captain Morgan. Okay. He's the same picture that you see. It's the same pictures ever since the beginning of Captain Morgan himself.
Tell you what, right? It looks like, but every time I've seen his face, I've been a little hammered. So,
right. So the point, but the contract that he signed, because at the time he was a young artist, he signed a contract where he got paid once for Captain Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And they're still using that likeness. So he hates Captain Morgan to his very soul at this point, because he knows that the rest of his contracts since then have written in rights buybacks. Because again, artist and doing art isn't something that you do all the time, depending on, you know, and even if you are, you're lucky if you're getting paid big bucks. So these artists and writers and actors, they're not, especially the ones who are getting paid the big bucks, they're not really fighting for themselves. The SAG isn't fighting for the big end actors.
No, they're fighting for all the guys that are just trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're fighting for all the guys just trying to make a living. They're fighting for the guys who could be a big name actor if he was exposed to the right people on a studio lot. Oh, but because, you know, there's this threat of using AI, let me get your likeness so we can use AI. And all of a sudden, these people don't have the kind of access to the industry they used to have. And then you run into a danger of these studios go back to the days where they are gatekeeping who gets to be famous and who doesn't.
They're the studios. I mean, I hate to say it, but it is part of our system. It is part of our system. We are a capitalist society, and I'm not, once again, it's devil's advocate. I'm not advocating. I'm not trying to say against the strike or anything. I'm on the side of the Actors Guild. I'm just saying you can't look at this. If you're trying to look at it fair, you have to look at both sides of it. And that is our country is what it's founded on, is capitalism. And, you know, according to sources on both sides, the biggest sticking point is unions demand for 2% of the revenue that's generated by streaming shows. That's a big chunk they want. I don't know if that's fair or not, but I'm just saying I don't know.
Yeah, because there's no revenue being made there, right? Because they're getting rid of everything on the streaming.
Well, you know, that's nonsense. They're making money or they wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, they're making money hand over fist in most cases.
You go back to like the 1950s and Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, right? They were smart. They were the ones that came in to Columbia Broadcasting System and said, hey, we're going to film in LA. We're not going to film in New York, where most TV was done. And the way that they shot TV back then is that they actually took a camera and actually recorded the television monitor of the thing that was being produced. When they shot in LA, because of the movie studios being in LA, they actually shot the Lucy show, right, on 35mm film. And Lucy and Desi, being smart, they said, we are going to own the film. So when Columbia Broadcasting System came to Lucy and said, hey, we want to rerun this over the summer because we don't have anything else to show, Lucy and Desi made money on that because they're the ones that own the rights to their work and then therefore were able to sell it as a rerun and earn those residuals.
But how is that applying to this current system where this is a fight between a union and the studios themselves? The studios have the streaming services. They own them. They own the content. They're developing that, you know, and some independent work still happens, and that's not really a big factor in this fight. It's really the streaming services and the major studios. They're not going to own anything. They never will. The studios own it. That is the system now. And I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that's the system. So what's the solution? I mean, they're both going to have to budge for sure. And you know, it's kind of wild how this all works, but the Lucy scenario, I don't know how that's going to apply, how that applies in any way.
Well, they could negotiate that in, because we want rights to our likeness and rights to our work. Therefore, in perpetuity, we want X dollars as part of that right. Because otherwise, you're just selling your rights away, just like you do when you work for corporate America.
Well, there's a lot of things they could do. I just don't think that the studios are bending. I don't feel like they want to bend that far. And it really feels like they are trying to wait this out so that the poor working actor and working writers have nothing to stand on financially, and they're desperate.
So let me ask a question for probably Aaron, who I would say knows the industry best. When a movie studio sells a product to a streaming service, do the actors make profit off of that sale?
Currently, only if it's in their contract, which it typically is not these days. What streaming has done, which is basically reinvent cable, there are no reruns. So they're just giving you a flat amount. And this is kind of like the Netflix model. Netflix created this. Netflix said, you know what? People are going to be streaming it. We don't know if they're going to watch it 5 times or 1,000 times. So we'll give you a flat amount. Bigger actors probably get, you know, an additional amount. But typically that's how it works. You get a flat amount. You don't get residuals because they don't report their numbers. And they don't want to report their numbers.
And if when a movie studio sells the film to another company so that way it can play in the theaters, at that point, actors do make profit, correct?
Yes, because those contracts have been established for many, many years.
So
this is a new distribution model.
And this is where I'm going with this. If the current model that allows actors to get paid and part of their income is generated based on that sale, that transaction, and we also know that many of these films that are on streaming services either never go to a theater or any other element other than this one streaming service that it's created, because if it's owned by the movie studio, they're selling it to themselves. Mm-hmm. And the actors are losing out on all of that profit margin that they used to for their income. To me, that's the issue. The issue is not that we're looking at changing the model. The issue is that this seems inequitable and unfair to the actors who are in productions that only go to streaming.
I totally agree with you. I was just playing devil's advocate earlier. I think you're absolutely right. I don't think it's fair.
But I think the point you made, though, was that you're making money on the sale to the movie theater.
You're
making money on the sale to the streaming service.
And they're saving money by not having to make the sale. So they have the profit that exists there, that additional amount now sits in their pocket. So now this company is just getting more money while the actors do not have anything to come out of that.
I would once again, here, devil's advocate that John doesn't like, is that if nobody watches it, the actors still got paid something, where the studio would lose money.
But
no one shares in the loss. You know what I mean? Like, no one shares in that loss. But the studio,
that's the same for every profit company that's out there.
I understand that, but you can't have it. You can't have it only the way it works for you.
The movie theater could work exactly the same as the streaming service. The movie theater could watch that movie every day for the entirety of its existence. They choose not to because the movie theater knows at some point there's a diminishing return where I'm not going to sell a seat in the theater to that show. Therefore, I pull the show from the movie theater, and therefore I don't make residuals for stuff that's in a movie theater. Streaming service is the same way. Sure. Stranger Things is probably a bad example. Cloverfield Paradox, whatever that third movie was, that wasn't that good. Cloverfield Paradox is on Netflix. It's sitting out there. It was made. People got paid, right? But I'm not coming to Netflix to watch Cloverfield Paradox. I'm coming because Netflix marketed the brand new Bridgerton thing, and I happened to pick up Cloverfield on the side because I remembered that Cloverfield was something I enjoyed in the mid-2000s. So it's not that Cloverfield's driving. If it's driving to the service, then you should get a residual. If it's not driving to the service and it's just there, you already got paid for what was there before.
I think it's just a matter of what you traditionally, for you and Aaron, how you guys view the traditional relationship. Because it goes back to John's point. There are plenty of other occupations and jobs and positions that do focus on giving you residuals, even if you're not actively employed in that role.
Across America, though, I would say it is not the case.
It's not the case. But the,
well, hang
the,
on,
the
I cut Amanda, is, hang on, I cut Amanda off.
Right. No, it's okay. Go ahead, because I was starting to cut John off. John hasn't talked in like 30 minutes, so
right. Okay. So, but it's not the case for a lot of America. But the point is that for those roles where it is the case, the selling point is the person. The selling point is...
No, that doesn't hold here. Because it doesn't hold as part of this argument because you're talking about 160,000 or whatever the number is, thousands and thousands and thousands of... They're trying to get those actors to make more money too. It's not just about Chris Hemsworth and Scarlett Johansson. It's actually about the lesser actors that do not bring, no matter...
Bazillions of dollars.
They do not bring faces to screens. They just don't. And it's nothing against them. I'm just saying they're background actors. They're regular guest cast, whatever it is. I mean, they're not established actors that are bringing people to the property. They're trying to fight for them to get more money based on something that they can't really identify yet.
And I'm not saying that they can't get any money either. I'm saying that there's other ways to make money.
Hang on, John, finish your thought.
Oh yeah, go ahead, John. Sorry, I thought you were done.
I lost it.
Well, just,
that's
why
I gave it to him. He had 30 seconds. I tried, John. Yeah. I tried.
You were focused on the people bringing in the streaming, and that's not the majority of what they're trying to strike for.
Okay, so my biggest point is that ultimately the thing that gives people their jobs is their faces, their presence on the screen,
yeah,
things that make them uniquely them. No matter who it is from one end of the screen to the other end of the screen, it doesn't matter who it is but ultimately actors show up and they bring something that makes them uniquely them. They're the only reason why it works. And if you can replace them, then fine, replace them. But in the moment, the piece of art itself in all of its elements works because that person showed up. And that's what my ultimate point is that if you, that person should be able to be, no matter what level of the screen time they get, they should be able to get, something to account for the fact that in perpetuity for the rest of the life of that piece of art, their exposure is what makes that piece of art work.
And I think that's the challenge. The challenge is that they're debating what is that piece, right? Because the music industry has figured this out already, right? I get a penny a play.
Have they? Not if they have music on Spotify.
No, they have not figured it out.
That's the point, right? They haven't figured it out in a place where it makes fair sense or whatever to everyone, because no matter what,
you totally just changed your point. You literally just said they've got to figure it out.
And they haven't figured out because they have a model. The model is figured out. The model is artists make music. That is the thing they put out into the system. If they put it on a streaming service, they get paid per play for every time it gets played. It's pennies, sometimes tenths of pennies on the dollar. It's not a lot of money, but they get paid for the residuals. The way artists make money is by putting on performances where Taylor Swift's tour just brought in three countries' gross domestic product.
Sure.
Because they have another way to make money. Actors need to figure out that it's a new world. They need to not rely just on their, I did this work, therefore I get paid. They also need to figure out a second thing of income. All of us are doing gig jobs on the side. We're doing this podcast as a gig job on the side. Like the world has changed. Okay.
When's that money start rolling in?
Yeah, what is that much? So, but the on the flip side though, you're using music. Okay, so a couple guys run into a studio and they make an album once. That album gets played several times on Spotify. Now, if they want to make extra money, they take that album and they play it in front of people over the span of a couple months, weeks, whatever it is, so they can make extra money. How does an actor do that? How does an actor go from, I'm working 2.5 months, 3 months on a television show, or I'm working a couple weeks on a television show, and then how do I then that television show owns all my time up until it's done, how do I work an additional gig on top of that?
Guys, capitalism is the problem. Let's just, that's the problem.
No.
That's where our solution is.
I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. But capitalism is the problem. It's also the solution. It's also the country. It's part of our country. You got to figure out a way to work in the system instead of trying to strip it down and start all over. That's my opinion. What I would say is, you know, I think residuals were created very much in the faith that this will help struggling actors make money while they're looking for jobs, because entertainment is not a guaranteed art form in many respects. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the right answer is. In my mind, like, you know, I've also been in the corporate environment a long time for many, many years. So I kind of look at it a different way probably, but I would say anyone who's not a top tier actor in terms of the billing would just give them a higher base rate. Cause I don't know if residuals are the right way to go in a streaming environment. It's a different world.
Yeah.
Because if you have to share in the wealth, you also got to share in the loss. Is that fair?
I mean, granted, your levels in the company don't work out the same way, but there's a different mix. The higher I go in a company, upper management, VP, director, et cetera, I have more leverage in the bonus side than I do in the base side. So my money gets made because the thing does well. Therefore, that's why executives get paid more in their bonuses than they do on their base salaries. Where on the other side, the hourly supervisor entry-level positions get more in the base rather than in the bonus.
I mean, we should probably move on because people are bored silly, but... ultimately, yeah. I'm on the side of the artists. I want them to succeed, and I want them to find some kind of fairness, because I do think the studios definitely reap way more of the benefits than struggling actors do. And you need them to make the work that we enjoy.
Yeah.
I just don't know what that answer is. And I don't know if 2% of everything is the way to go either. I don't know if that's the answer. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. I'm obviously in support of the artists themselves. I don't know what the answer or how much money or whatever it is that's going to take. I don't really care, because it's not my problem. But I at the same time, I support them. But in the meantime, I'm going to get into watching all the shit that I left behind, and I'm backed up on.
I know. I'm finally almost through Ted Lasso. So 2 episodes left. That's all I got. 2 episodes left.
I'm starting to come around to the John idea. I did get through 2 TV series in the last couple
of
weeks.
Stop it. Don't you do it. Don't be on his bandwagon. Don't do it.
Hey, we gotta pay those residuals when we can, right?
Yeah.
also want to mention AMC Theaters did drop its price for better seats plan, and Netflix is dropping its cheapest no ads plan. So a couple lessons being learned, and they're different lessons. I don't know. But if you didn't know, AMC's plan was, if you get prime seats, we're going to charge you more for them. They tried that in test markets, and people said a giant middle finger to AMC on that one. So thankfully, they learned that lesson. But Netflix, on the other hand, they want to kill their no ads plan, because everything they're doing is making more money for them, I guess, so they can pay out more to these unions.
And AMC, I think, had the right idea. They were comparing it to like going to like a Broadway play, where to sit center orchestra versus upper left balcony, you're definitely paying more than the upper left balcony. The difference is that nobody wants to pay more. So I expect when I go to a Broadway show that it's going to cost me $300 to sit in the orchestra center stage, and that it's going to cost me $70 to go sit up in the balcony left side obstructed view seat, right? The difference with AMC is they went the other way and said, we're going to take your $300 seat and make it a $400 seat. That's bullshit.
Here's what I'll say. Until you get your shit together and you start making people sit in their goddamn assigned seating, because they keep seeing that problem pop up left and right, don't talk to me about wanting to charge more for preferred seating. I'm not going to sit there and fight with some idiot because they don't know how assigned seating works. And that seems to keep happening. Amanda, you
also,
were
how about
something.
You give me Hang the on. Family plan you promised me 3 years ago on the A-list?
They're never doing that. Amanda, you were going to say something.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm not a fan of the idea, but I think if we're using Troy's analogy and weird comparisons again, in that circumstance also...
it was in an article. It's not a weird comparison. It's how the whole thing came about.
There's the difference between a Broadway show and a movie theater showing is that at a Broadway show, you're getting a performance, you're getting something that potentially nobody else is going to get Even if someone falls, that's an experience nobody else is going to get. You're paying for that live experience. You're also paying for something that's much more limited. They're not doing Broadway shows every 2 hours, every week for approximately, I don't know, 12 weeks or so if it's a really good movie. Probably not that long anymore. But the point is, like, you're going to – you have less opportunity. And so when you have less opportunity, that increases the cost of it. And it makes it more of like a high quality thing. For movies, and the other part of it is, for movies, they're already overpriced. Like, they are already costing us an incredible amount of money for like one single movie ticket. Like, for those of us with A-list, we are eternally grateful because one movie ticket in IMAX at night is the same cost of the entire membership for a month.
$20 for Oppenheimer this weekend.
Which is ridiculous. It doesn't matter what market you're in.
I'm sorry, suckers. Get on A-list.
Truly,
every major chain has a plan now, so get on whatever it is.
But it's still not far off, because if I sit on the far end, if I sit in seat 1 or seat 30, right at the ends of the aisles, I'm going to have a diminished viewing experience, because every mother effer that's got to get up during the movie and get new popcorn like Aaron, or go to the bathroom in the middle of the movie like my wife,
or like Aaron,
they're going to walk past me and ruin my movie experience. Versus if I sat in the middle, no one's getting up and bothering
somebody me. Walk past you and that's going to ruin your movie experience.
Yes. That's why I don't go to John's Theater, where fucking waiters are like coming through all the time, bringing food and stuff. Cause it's annoying. It's distracting.
Yeah, it's a whole way they do it. So they definitely don't do it directly through the movie, except for minorly. But I haven't been to that theater in a little while. So I got a funny story about people walking into the theater, though.
Okay, go.
So I went to go see with my buddy Eli, my friend Albert, and Eli's son. We went to go see Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And during the movie... Now it's the three older gentlemen and the son is at the end of us, right? And during the movie, Jack had to get up and go to the bathroom, and then Jack had to get up and go to the concession stand, and then Jack had to get up and do something else. And the kid got up like four times through the movie, and each time he got up, he chose to walk over us as opposed to going the other direction, which he had a clear shot to the other side. And he can easily go down the stairs, but every single time he got up and left, he was like coming back up, crossing over with us, and then falling over us at some point. And we were just like, what are you doing? And poor Eli is just shaking his head at his son the entire time. I love it.
I think we're all not laughing because we would be having a really bad time if that happened.
Yeah.
I don't get focused. I have a very easy time focusing in on what's going on. I don't get easily distracted.
I get easily distracted.
I think people, the more you focus on something, the more, you know, it's going to be an issue for you. And don't get me wrong, there are definitely times. Last two times I've been, somebody was in reserved seating that they weren't supposed to be in. Last two times. And the first time I had to explain to a lady how reserved seating worked. And she's like, oh, I didn't understand that. I'm like, I know for a fact you actually have to pick a seat to get a ticket. So you do know how it works. You're just kind of being an asshole. But, you know, I didn't say any of that, of course, because I'm a delightful person. And then when I went and saw Barbie, there was like a whole row of people that took these seats and were arguing. And this lady's like, I got the tickets. And then eventually someone came in and said, oh, no, you're in the wrong seats, and made them move. But, you know, I just don't understand why assigned seating got so complicated for people.
Why do you need an AMC
problem? I think that's a people problem.
Maybe.
It is. Why do you need manager intervention for every little thing? Like, can you not just be an adult?
Assholes. No, God. They can't. They can't. It's me, me, me. I think COVID made everybody more me than they were before, and they were already so me.
Yep.
Yep.
And when I say me, I mean John. Let's go to our From the Outside In topic.
Yep.
All right, we're talking about Comic-Con 2023. That's our topic this week. Any big news that came from down there? And I gotta say, man, it's really weird because this year, because of the strike, the Screen Actors Guild and the Writers Guild, a lot of actors did not go to promote their films. Directors still can because they fall under the Directors Guild. That's different. So Chris Nolan, Greta Gerwig, even though she wrote Barbie, she was a director, so she can promote the movie from that capacity. But actors didn't go out and promote their projects unless they were an indie actor. There's some, and some weird waivers that are being offered to random big celebrities that also, you know, I'll make it an indie movie. Can I get a waiver? And then suddenly Matthew McConaughey suddenly is getting a waiver, whatever. That's a whole other thing. What do you think of this whole no stars promoting this year and major studios pulling out completely, like right before the event? Amanda, what do you think? You're big on festivals.
It's really disappointing. I know that Comic-Con was intended to be more about comics, obviously, but so much of it has changed and morphed into something more. And I know there's a lot of people who can't afford to do meet and greets at the Comic-Cons, but they go because they know that they're going to be able to see that person or just be able to like watch them interact with other people or their team, their colleagues on like a panel or something. There's just a lot of fun experiences for people who are doing the moderating of panels. They're losing out on those opportunities. So all around, I feel like it's just really disheartening. But in the same respect, I understand why it's happening. You probably don't want to continue marketing and helping these companies profit because then it feels like they're winning when you're trying to help them understand that, you know, we're striking, like essentially there are workers on strike. Mm-hmm. So, they actually are. So when you think about that, you wouldn't expect someone who's on strike with like their local Teamsters to be like, all right, guys, I'm going to just volunteer to help you out with this construction work here. And, you know, we'll take care of this today. No, they're on a strike and you have to make the point. So
I don't know. I'm torn. Because
like Natalie and Brugula?
Maybe. That's funny.
Thanks. It made me laugh.
I'm still laughing over here.
I don't
You care. You broke Troy.
I guess like part of me is like it was fun because Aaron and I obviously moderated some panels for a Comic-Con like event. So it's nice to see the actors and people and the fans get excited and all of that stuff. At the same time, it's like, I don't need it because if I learned anything from the pandemic, E3, I don't have to go to E3 to get the content. Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo all put out their stuff. Apple puts out their stuff. It's a YouTube video. I get the information I need.
Yeah.
So the fact that they were, what I'm pissed off about is the fact that people have to buy Comic-Con tickets a year in advance in order to get their tickets because they expect these things to happen. Mm-hmm. And in this case, this year, they didn't get what they paid for. So I'm hoping Comic-Con like made it right with people to say, hey, for every panel, maybe there was a residual thing. For every panel that was canceled, you got a penny back or something. I don't know.
I'm sure they did not.
But that sucks for the fans. The fan part sucks. But what this looks like going forward from a Comic-Con perspective, I'd be just fine with Comic-Con going away completely and focusing on comics. Move the TV stuff to where it belongs. The Paley Fest, ATX Festival, South by Southwest. That's where it belongs.
Are you actually done this time, or is it going to be another long pause and you're just going to talk over me again?
I don't know.
Did you start talking yet? John's getting stressed.
There you go. Get frustrated. Get saucy. I like it.
All right. So I was looking at a lot of the articles about what's going on at Comic-Con, and some of it was still very good, and the reception to a lot of things was still very good. They obviously have a lot more than just the Hall H features available to the people who got to go. Do I still feel a little bit sorry for those people who were expecting something else when they signed up for their tickets a year ago? Yes, I do. However, I feel like they got what they could have gotten no matter what at a Comic-Con. The thing that I try to remember when it comes to the Hall H features and all that is that those are what made Comic-Con more mainstream. That's what helped fandom and nerddom really start to become more of a front runner in what's okay in the world and what's available. And so seeing a little of that go away this year was the part that really made it sad for me, because those people, like Troy is pointing out, that those people who paid for those tickets, they got kind of robbed. That's not the only reason why people go to Comic-Con, but it is what made it mainstream. So I'm a little disappointed for them, but also they probably had a really good show out of it anyways.
They did. Let's get into some of the news. We're going to talk about some of the stuff that stuck out to us. We each kind of like have our own little section where we can talk about anything that really resonated with us. because the Hall H was not stuffed with megastars this year, things like an Indian movie named Project K were able to take the stage with an awesome looking trailer, which I highly recommend you find it, and live singers and dancers. The Nag Ashwin directed and written sci-fi pick is inspired by Hindu mythology where an evil rises to destroy all gods. And it looks pretty kick-ass. And that would never be in Hall H because it would be relegated to some smaller room down the way. But because, you know, no superheroes, none of that stuff, this was able to debut there. And it was a big hit. People really, really dug it.
That's really cool. And I find that to be very inspiring, or actually makes me hopeful what the possibilities for Comic-Con could be in the future, where instead of it just being something where all these known properties are showing up to be like, here's our stuff, where it becomes something more about, here's this indie thing that's going to be Comic-Con related or genre related. Here's this other thing from a different country that's genre related that you might actually love. And I would like to see a lot of that happening in the way of spreading the good word of what's available in entertainment.
That would be awesome.
I could also, because of something smaller like this, I could actually get in the freaking building and see what it is. Because I don't have to wait in line for 4 days in order to get to the one thing I wanted to see and then still not get in.
I just love how you and John both look at this as wins for just you personally. Like, strikes, well, it's easy for content for me. And also make the lines a little shorter at Comic-Con. Me. We were just bitching about the me people. You're me people.
Wait a minute. How did I get dragged into this?
Because you've said many times that the writer's strike you were okay with, because now you get caught up on stuff. Because less content being produced.
But I just said something positive for everybody for something else.
I spent the entire time. Go ahead,
Troy.
Troy, you got to let him finish, man. You got to let him finish. You got to let other people talk. It's okay.
I thought he was done.
You didn't even give me a three count, Troy.
Like literally mid-sentence, but go ahead.
I spent the entire time fighting for the artists or talking about how the artists have their rights or whatever it is that whole time. And then I make a joke about, this is good for me. Troy is literally going, I get what I want. And you're like bunching
it's
me in.
It's literally the same point. It's literally the same point. Benefit to me. Same point.
I'm fighting for the thousands of people that got sunburned waiting in line in 90 degree heat. That has nothing to do with me. That has to do with everybody else waiting in line, dying.
Yeah, but you're only bringing that up because it affected you.
It didn't affect me. I've never been to Comic-Con. Never been to South by Southwest. Okay. Never been to ATX.
Me, you bitches.
Now it sounds like he's whining that he hasn't gone to any of these.
Oh, wait a minute. How's this going to affect South by?
Hey, you be quiet. It'll be solved by then. It'll be solved by then. Borderlands confirmed its August 9th, 2024 release date, which is more than 3 years after the film wrapped, I believe. And Eli Roth is directing it. I've said before, I like Eli. He's a great fan, not a great director, my opinion. And Kate Blanchett stars in this. It's based on the video game. If you ever play the video game Borderlands, it's pretty wild. But the fact that it still keeps getting pushed back tells me this is about what I was going to expect from Eli Roth. This is actually bad news for me, but they're trying to pimp it as a positive. So there's that. And lastly, Saw X, Saw 10. It's just like Fast and Furious. It won't die. It's coming out September 29th, and they found a way to bring Tobin Bell back, which is amazing.
This is my most favorite ridiculous news that's come out of this year.
Stupid. It's set between Saw 1 and Saw 2. Because if you never saw Saw 3, they decided to kill him off when he's obviously the most important component to the Saw movies. Dumb, dumb play. And they've been trying to get back to that moment ever since. Well, Tobin Bell's back. A sick and desperate John travels to Mexico for a risky and experimental procedure in hopes of a miracle cure for his cancer, only to discover the entire operation is a scam to defraud the most vulnerable. And then he gets back to his work, turns the tables on these con artists, and does his devious, deranged, and ingenious traps.
If he's sick and dying, how is he killing people?
Well, obviously, the cancer's not in stage 4 yet. I don't know the answer to it. I really, really don't know the answer to it. I just think it's ridiculous. Like, just let it go. Why is this such big news for you, Amanda?
Well, I mean, I love the Saw movies. They're a lot of fun. And I, as much as I know that Tobin Bell was a phenomenal component to the movies and would have been great to keep him around. I just feel like it's so absurd to try to go back to, I don't know, revisit the same things and try to find, oh, we've got like a a week here where he was still alive between this one and next one. So let's just try to get that in real quick. We'll Isn't make a story weird? Out of that.
It's just wild how they're, it's just wild. I got nothing else to say about it. It's just wild. But, you know, happy for fans if they're excited, and I'm sure it'll make some money. And the most recent ones haven't really done that well. So they'll try anything with Saw. Yeah.
It sounds so absurd to me. Like, this was one of those things where I'm like, okay, this is taking a property way too far.
But then we go to the newest Fast and Furious movie every chance we get. So we should just
do. That's also taking a property way too far, but we kind of like that.
Oh, well.
All right. So I went ahead and jumped in there because my panels, or my three choices of what I decided was important enough to talk about from Comic-Con came up. So
you did not write anything in the format. And I think we had explicit instructions that if you didn't have anything in here, tough shit.
You were going to get skipped.
Isn't that?
Yep.
Can I just sit on my hands then?
No, go ahead. It's fine. I'm just letting everybody know the other two did their job. I'm just saying.
I copied and pasted into my format, and everyone had already made their choices, so I made sure that I didn't step on anyone's toes.
What are your three things?
Which is impressive, considering Troy had 1,300 on his list.
Yeah, Troy really made it difficult because he's like, I'm going to talk about everything.
Troy trims it down a little bit, but go ahead.
Dear God, he's like, I have something to talk about. Orphan Black Echoes. It got canceled. Boy.
Already?
The panel. Like, what are you going to talk about, Troy? I had it on my list too till I realized there was no goddamn thing to talk about.
Because it got canceled.
Okay, but what's the
discussion? Troy actually has like individual episodes. What the fuck do you need individual episodes of shows on here for?
No.
Break it down, man.
High level.
I was in the theater for 8 hours yesterday and I had to get this done while it was in between movies. So
Troy is that's what I had. Literally his own chat GPT.
Right.
Yep.
Go ahead, John.
All right.
What do you got?
Well, speaking of chat GPT, Masters of Universe Revolution. So Kevin Smith did an announcement for this. It's the follow-up to the animated series Masters of the Universe Revelations. This has taken on a more mature route on the journey of He-Man, Attorney, and his allies. Kevin Smith recently revealed that there are some new tidbits about Netflix's follow-up to this. While the original voice actors are coming back for this, we are going to be getting Keith David is going to be joining the cast. We know Keith David from a lot of his other things, primarily The Thing. But along with what he's going to be doing is he's going to be lending his voice to voice talents to one of the most notable villains in Eternia's history, which is the antagonist Hordak. Which, if you don't remember who Hordak was primarily She-Ra's main villain.
But the movie's dead, right? Like the live action
movie. The movie died. Yeah. This is why Netflix like doesn't want to pay actors now. Right, they spent $30 million and said, no.
But this is like season two or three of Masters of the Universe.
This is season two of the animated series.
Wasn't that universally hated?
Yeah, it was.
Reviled?
I don't know about universally hated. It was. There was a loud voice of people hating it because it really didn't follow He-Man very closely. It followed Teela more. It was more like her story.
Okay. All right. I'm just clarifying. What's your number two there? Unless somebody has some Masters of the Universe they wanted to discuss. I didn't like that series. I watched one episode. I didn't like it. So I got none of those.
I enjoyed the series. I thought it was a great story, and I even liked the fact that it didn't really circle around He-Man until the very end. My number two is Metalocalypse, the Army of the Doomster, which we have the Metalocalypse crew coming back from a movie. And this movie is going to release on Blu-ray and digital August 22nd. The voice actors were available for this whole thing. And it's just going to be fun. If you're a fan of the Adult Swim series, it's going to carry more of that same feeling that the Adult Swim series has.
What's it called? Apocalypse?
Metalocalypse, Army of the Doomster. So Metalocalypse is this, it's a story about a metal band, and they get into all sorts of weird
things. Oh, is this like Deathlok or something like that?
It is Deathlok.
Okay. All right, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Do you want to know what my favorite thing about this interaction that just happened, and it's also probably the funniest thing, that John can't make out the word "the," but he can make out Metalocalypse or whatever the fuck the word is that Aaron couldn't get, I couldn't get, and yet somehow he just so seamlessly was like, nah, 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 nah.
I didn't get it at all because it wasn't written on the format, so I don't know what the hell it was.
That's funny.
Hey, my shared stutter comes in the weirdest ways.
It's just funny. I love it.
Shared. It's like the more you challenge my tongue, the more it works. I don't get it.
That's what she said.
All right. So we also had Robert Kirkman showed up to do a panel for Invincible, which season 2 is finally getting a release. Release date of November 3rd. And as well as some of the things that they announced, one of the cool things they did was just this weekend, they dropped a new hour-long episode of Invincible that circles around the character of Adam Eve. I watched it. It's really good. So if you really enjoy that series, it's a great way to hold.
Wait, they dropped
over
a whole new episode?
Yep.
Didn't know that. That's the first animated show I've watched the entire season of in forever. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they dropped one episode that's an hour long, and it's it's all about Adam Eve's story. So it was a really good episode. Their first four episodes of the eight
episode season.
That's what I meant.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Yep. Will drop November 3rd, and then the second four episodes will drop sometime early 2024.
So I did better with this not seeing it on a format than you did reading it off your notes. You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome. But I still can't say really Metalocalypse or whatever the fuck that is.
So, Metalocalypse?
Yeah, can't do it.
Yeah, I can barely say the.
Omni-Man's going to be in Mortal Kombat. The next iteration of Mortal Kombat. That's pretty cool.
Omni-Man and what's his face from The Boys?
Homelander, right?
Homelander. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anthony. It's Anthony. It's not Anthony. It's Anthony Starr.
It's Anthony?
Anthony Starr.
Anthony Starr?
Anything else, Jenny?
No, that's it. I wasn't going to take everyone's time like apparently Choi's going to do with something that doesn't even have a panel.
I want to see.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Go.
All right. Well, my panel starts with Good Omens Season 2. Attendees got a first look at the first episode of Season 2, which drops at the end of July.
I'm excited.
Afterwards, they were also treated to a 6-minute behind-the-scenes video to get fans pumped, and they would also made an announcement that August 4th there'll be additional content that'll drop as bloopers and behind-the-scenes. Season 2 returns Michael Sheen as Azrael, David Tennant as Crowley, and this time they are helping Archangel Gabriel figure out who the hell he is. Or it is, or whatever they are, because it starts at the beginning of time, before the beginning of time, and all the way to present day. So it's a 1,000-year journey. Check out Good Omens on Amazon Prime at the end of July.
I'm excited for that, man. That was such a great
show. Excited. The first season is so funny. Yeah, I mean, especially if you have any kind of biblical context, I piss my pants laughing at why the unicorns only don't exist anymore. It's funny. It's a funny scene. Over at the Walking Dead land, that's right, Walking Dead never dies. The Walking Dead Dead City was renewed for season 2, announced at Comic-Con, which is not surprising, giving the reveal in episode 5 of the Maggie and Negan TV show. Mm-hmm. Season 1 just finished this week, so you can catch all 6 episodes now on AMC and AMC Plus. Daryl Dixon show is going to drop September 10th. We got a trailer for that and an early season 2 renewal already, before it's even aired, because spoiler alert, Carol is back. No shocker there. Also, Fear Season 8 Part 2 will drop October 22nd, and that's a character-long thought right into the end. There's actually someone coming back for that. That's going to be quite interesting, and that'll be the end of Fear. Fear will end with Season 8. And then we also got a Rick and Michonne teaser trailer. Looks like The Ones Who Live will be the name of that show, which will be coming in 2024. That title is no surprise given what happened at the end of the Walking Dead main series.
It feels, doesn't it feel like Rick and Michonne is going to be like the true Walking Dead series ender as opposed to season 11 or whatever?
I don't think so. I think it's just never ending. Because Daryl ends up in France, just so everybody is aware. How
weird.
He ends up in France is going to be what's explored during the course of the show.
I don't want to watch the Daryl Dixon show until Carol comes back. Can you just like give me a heads up when she's back on it?
Well, she's got to find him in France. I mean, she needs a couple episodes to find him.
I'm really trying to figure out like how that's going to work. How are you going to get Carol to find Daryl in France when there's no communication method?
I don't understand how Maggie and Negan work together, but it does. It was actually a really great.
Did you watch
it? Six episodes. I did.
Oh,
it was really good. Six episodes. It's interesting.
Was it like Escape from New York? Because every commercial and poster looked like Escape from New York.
Kind of, but there's reasons.
Can I just watch it without having to catch up?
I would definitely watch the last.
I still got to watch the last couple episodes, but
I would watch the last couple episodes of 11.
Okay.
It makes more sense of why they're together.
Do you want this franchise to die? Does anybody think that why is this still going on?
Yes. Or do you, okay.
I want to see the cure. I want to know what the hell they do to cure the thing.
They're not going to cure it.
So nobody.
Keep going. If you've got good
cares?
Stories, keep going.
Why?
Fear got much better when Morgan joined the show. Morgan's not on the show anymore.
I watched like two episodes and I'm like, I was with you. And then I watched the third one. I'm like, nope, I'm back to hating the show. I'm out. I tried though. Morgan's the only thing that I like in Fear. I do love Morgan.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, he's not back for the second half of season 8. So,
well, I'm going to catch up on that.
Clone Club was super excited because Orphan Black Echoes was coming, but the panel got canceled. They were going to basically get a little bit of the behind the scenes on what the show is going to be bringing to the table as Kristen Ritter, Jessica Jones fame, and Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23 is going to be the lead. And she's also producing this version, which takes place many, 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 many years in the future. John Fawcett, the original creator, said that the spinoff is a very different show as they explore the scientific manipulation of the human existence. So do not expect necessarily Tatiana Maslany to show up or other clones, but it might not even be dealing with clones at all, but it's definitely set in the Orphan Black universe. So definitely check that out when it finally shows up sometime in 2023. We're running out of time, so don't know if that's going to happen or not. And then the Star Trek universe panel, Discovery sneak peek of the fifth season, which helped launch the service at Paramount originally, will end in early 2024. The fifth and final season will find Captain Burnham and the crew of Discovery uncovering a mystery that will send them on an epic adventure across the galaxy to find an ancient power that has been deliberately hidden for centuries. Anybody think the Borg are going to be involved? That would be cool.
There's a lot of Star Trek going on at Paramount. Only, I think, too much, honestly.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Paramount Plus also revealed that the official trailer for season 4 of the original animated comedy series Star Trek Lower Decks, which is funny as shit, also announced that it's going to debut on Thursday, September 7th. The new teaser art was revealed as well, which is an homage to Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Super cool poster. And Strange New World season 2 is going to get a crossover episode with Lower Decks. I don't know how that's going to be possible since Lower Decks takes place in the post-TNG Janeway era and Strange New Worlds is well before Star Trek original series. So that should be interesting how that's going to play in.
One's animated, one's not.
Yeah, apparently the premise is that the animated characters get sucked into some kind of space anomaly that turns them into 3D real people.
And vice versa.
Sent back in time.
I gotcha. Okay.
And that episode actually dropped immediately at Comic-Con during the panel and later that night on the service. So that was episode 7 of the second season of Strange New Worlds. So that aired on Saturday, and then they're going to go back to the regular Thursday schedule for the rest of the run, including the special August 3rd episode, which is the 9th episode of season 2. Well, we will deal with Subspace Rhapsody. That is correct. Strange New Worlds, Star Trek season 2 is getting the musical episode.
Can we talk about this for a second before you jet on to your next 14 things?
Yeah.
Why? I can't find a single Star Trek fan out there that wants that. Now that it's been announced, every single comment's been negative. Now, maybe it'll be fantastic. It'll blow us away. We'll be like, holy shit, why did they never do a musical Star Trek before? This sounds like something that is jumping the shark of Star Trek in general.
At the same time, though, to play devil's advocate, because I know John loves that so much, that they're on a 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds, and we don't know what's out there in the Alpha Quadrant
world?
At this point in time. So what if you run into an alien species where they basically force you to sing all the time?
And they're like, hey, once more with feeling.
That's right. 10 original songs have been written for this particular episode. And Subspace Rhapsody is actually a playoff of the series' main title. So you can actually get the album on all of the streaming services as soon as the episode airs on August 3rd. And then the second season will finish off on the 10th of August. But yeah, it's great so far. Strange New Worlds is still firing on all cylinders. Check it out. It's some of the best Trek because it gives old fans what they love, but it also makes it inviting for new fans to come on in.
I love Ansem Elgort.
Ansem is a great captain.
Love Ansem Elgort. Wonder if he's going to sing. I would assume they all have to sing, right? Isn't that part of the deal? It's just like Buffy when they did there.
And for all the stuff that I wrote, I challenge everybody to go look at the times of everybody's panels and whose was the shortest. Because I think I covered a lot in a very short period of time. Thank you very much.
Now he's being really sensitive. Fuck you, bitches.
I mean, mine's literally going to take a minute and a half. So
that's what she said. Go ahead.
Jamie Lee Curtis's Mother Nature, a candid discussion of her all-new graphic novel and movie. So she had made a special appearance at Comic-Con so she could launch her new graphic novel called Mother Nature, which debuted exclusively at Comic-Con. It's an eco-horror graphic novel that is adapted from her script for the Comet Pictures Blumhouse film. Co-written by Russell Goldman and artist Carl Stevens. We're also on stage with Mrs. Curtis. And they went behind the scenes for the project, and the movie is coming up. So I'm excited to not only see the graphic novel, but also see the movie that's coming out. I think that's really cool. And I love Jamie Lee Curtis and Lady Power. So,
oh, she's great. It's hard not to love her.
And it's horror. I'm all about it.
Sure. So you're going to pick up this eco-horror graphic novel, are you? Or are you just going to wait for the movie? You're going to wait for the movie?
I'll wait for the movie and then I'll check out the novel.
That's what I thought.
Yep. So also, something that debuts September 22nd on Peacock. the 3-part John Wick prequel series, The Continental, is going to be debuting there. So they announced the date, and that will follow Colin Woodall as a young Winston Scott battling through 1970s New York City. You can expect plenty of guns and fighting, which is what we anticipate and expect out of all of our John Wick properties. The Continental does air its first episode on September 22nd and the second episode on September 29th, and it closes with the final chapter on October 6th.
And I think they're each like 2 hours. So it's like a 6-hour deal, I thought.
Heck yeah, love it.
I think so, I could be wrong.
And do we expect gunfighting? I mean, could I have cool sword play and axe play? I mean, there was
a lot
of...
You don't know what they're going to get. Why do you say play after it like it's a sexual thing? Axe play, booty play,
because they call it sword play. Sword play is a
sword
term.
I call it sword fighting.
Well, it's called... There's sword play.
Okay.
It's called sword.
You know who made it sexy?
I don't know. It's just...
Sexual? You.
You did.
No, it's the fact that it came out of Troy's mouth.
He didn't say booty play. He didn't say finger stuff.
I added that in.
He
didn't
say
finger stuffs either.
He just said swordplay.
Wait, isn't booty stuff and
butt stuff the same?
The same?
Guess depends on who's driving.
And we went there.
And we're moving on. Guess what? Now we're going to move into some spoiler-free reviews. We're going to start with Oppenheimer.
So, Oppenheimer, however you say this film, which I know Troy is going to correct everyone on how to pronounce, recently came out alongside of Barbie. It is about the story of American scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer and his role in the development of the atomic bomb, which already sounds like a really depressing experience, but then it's 3 hours long. How did that runtime feel for you, Troy?
Like an hour and a half.
What?
It clipped along so majestically that you didn't even think about what the time was. You were so engrossed in the story, engrossed on getting to the point of when they actually were going to drop the test bomb. And then what happens after that is actually a whole other movie into itself. And that was just as fascinating as the first 90 minutes.
Does it feel like a slow burn? Because I struggle with slow burns that are also 3 hours long.
Yeah, I mean, the first half an hour really introduces people to the cast of characters that are going to influence Dr. Oppenheimer's life. Doctor is important. And I think from that perspective, if you're not big into biopics, that's where people could probably kind of like, you know, I'm going to take my nap after my half hour of trailers and popcorn overdose that I do in that first 30 minutes. And you probably wouldn't miss a ton. But at the same time, there's a lot of setup in that first half hour of, you know, how they got to the point of actually thinking about quantum mechanics and making an atomic bomb or a hydrogen bomb and things that they wanted to do in order to move it forward, and how the military gets involved and how the war is playing out and how the Communist Party fits into the whole thing. So there's a lot of just good backstory in that first hour that might seem like it's a throwaway until you get into the good stuff of when Los Alamos finally comes online and they start working on the bomb itself, because the back half of the movie is actually where it gets really interesting, especially with Robert Downey Jr.'s character.
Yeah, that was also something I was going to ask you. This film has got a stacked cast. We have Cillian Murphy, Emily Blunt, Matt Damon, RDJ. You have Kenneth Branagh, who's in it. You have all different kinds of really impressive and talented actors in this slate. Do you feel like you get adequate time with each of them, or does anyone come out feeling underrepresented because we're so focused on Oppenheimer?
I mean, the back half of the movie is focused on the I want to call it the battle between Strauss and Oppenheimer and what went down in the wake of the bombing of Japan and the Atomic Energy Commission that comes after that. So really it's focused on those two gentlemen. So yeah, you do get a scene with Rami Malek in there. You get some scenes in the beginning of the movie with Florence Pugh as well. Obviously, Matt Damon shows up every now and then because he's the general who has to bark around orders. So I think that everybody plays the roles they're supposed to play. And when they're on screen doing the role they're supposed to play, it's just amazing. Like every ounce of screen time they get, if it's 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or 2 hours, they all take the time that they have and play it to 11. It's just, it's an amazing magnum opus, if you will, of what you think about when you say classic Hollywood movies. This is a classic Hollywood movie. This has got great visuals, great sound, great direction, great acting. And it's just, I mean, you just sit there and take it in, and it's just so much going on that you really don't even notice the time.
So my last question for you is about Mr. Chris Nolan. I love this guy. He has such a way of putting visuals on display for us, especially chaos and catastrophe. He's just done so great with that, and also getting your mind engaged in different ways. But he also tends to have an audio issue with dialogue and sound. Do you feel like you see that very stereotypical Christopher Nolan directing here, or is there improvement? Or
I think that he embraces it in this movie, I think is the best way to say it. A lot of people are actually equating this to somewhat of a horror film in a way, because what you're actually experiencing through the course of the movie is the mind of Dr. Oppenheimer. You're actually visually being presented with how his mind is thinking about fission reactors, fusion reactors, the consequences of such things. When people are yelling and screaming at him, the volume is over trumping the words being yelled at him, because you're actually experiencing his mental load just being crushed under the weight of the speech, the attacks, the slander, the scientists yelling, you know, to try to get their point of view across. You're actually in Dr. Oppenheimer's mind through most of the film. And because of that, that audio issue you may have seen in the past where you're trying to understand what somebody's saying, you're not supposed to understand it. You're supposed to feel like Oppenheimer felt. And there's a moment in the movie, you know, the I don't know if it's a spoiler or not, they've said on numerous things that you actually get to see the nuclear explosion happen during the test at Los Alamos. And just that sequence alone is just cinematic gold in every way possible. And it's because you spent that first hour and a half literally living as Oppenheimer, getting to that point, that you're just on the edge of your seat the entire time, just as he's on the edge of his seat in his protective box.
So if the full price of admission were $10, what are you giving? Is it Oppenheimer?
Oppenheimer. Did I get it right? Oppenheimer. Dr. Oppenheimer. Okay, solid $9.
Wow. And you saw this one in IMAX, so you got to see it in the glory that it was filmed in.
So this is a really great point to bring up to people. There are IMAX theaters that are true 70 millimeter presentation screens on classic film projectors. And then there are digital IMAX theaters, which majority of the world has now moved to. So there are only about 30 theaters in the entire world that actually can show this in the film 70 millimeter version. From the Chicago area, the closest one, I believe, is in Indianapolis, 3.5 hours away. So I did not see it in its full real capacity, but it was on a big enough screen that you get enough of the mushroom cloud.
Awesome.
Wow. That's intense. I did not get to see it this week, but I am hoping to go see it really, really, really soon.
Ditto. Yeah,
and I should have a review up on the website shortly at thehollywoodoutsider.com.
You do. It is up. Sweet. All right. Now we're going to move on. We're coming to Barbie. Don't worry, people. We're getting to Barbie. But first, we have a review of Talk to Me, which is in theaters July 28th. Amanda and I saw this at South by Southwest. So here is that review of Talk to Me. Definitely recommend this one.
All right. So our next one is Talk to Me. And this is about a lonely teenager named Mia who gets hooked on the thrills of conjuring spirits through a ceramic hand. But when she is confronted by a soul claiming to be her dead mother, she unleashes a plague of supernatural forces. It's directed by Danny Filippu and Michael. It seems like they're related in some capacity. And then we have Sophie Wilde, Miranda Otto, Alexandra Jensen, and some others in here. Aaron, tell us your thoughts on Talk to Me.
Yeah, I think it's Filippo, Danny and Michael. And look, this is a horror movie, first and foremost. These are emerging horror directors. This is a wild movie. The concept is they've created a party game out of a hand, right? And it seems like the hand is demonically possessed. So anyway, it sits down in a chair, they shake the hand, and they're going to see someone dead on the other side. And if they say the words like "let me in" or "I allow you inside" or whatever, I can't remember the exact terminology because I saw this one at the beginning of the festival, and there are a lot of movies after that. But when you allow the demon inside, you've got a certain amount of time before they take full control of one's body, and when that happens, a lot of different things can happen, and they end up making it a party game, and it seems like, oh, that's ridiculous. Who would do that? And my first thought was everybody. Everybody that's a teenager. I mean, do you ever watch TikTok? Yes, they would do this, and they're filming it, and they're getting a lot of kicks out of it. And even though there's a kid at the beginning of the movie that gets killed over this, they still keep doing it. And it ends up just getting more and more amped up until it just goes just batshit crazy. And the whole movie is held together by Sophie Wilde, who stars as Mia. She's the lead. She's the one who lost her mother. She's really struggling. And she plays every facet of a person struggling with grief. She's happy, she's sad, she's miserable, she's angry, she's hurt, all of that. And she does a wonderful job. She carries the film. She makes the film terrifying when it's terrifying and unnerving when it's unnerving and also fun when it's fun. I really enjoyed it.
Again, full price of admission, $10. What are you giving Talk to Me?
7. I give this one a 7. This is a horror movie I think everybody needs to pay attention to when it comes out.
Nice. That's a pretty good score.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next, Sympathy for the Devil, which is releasing in theaters July 28th as well. And this is Nick Cage in Ooh-wee Good Looking at its full cagiest.
Yeah, so Aaron got a chance to go ahead and see this. And so, Aaron, this is directed by Yuval Adler. Am I close? Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's right.
All right, cool. And it's written by Luke Paradise. I know I got that one right.
That's an awesome name.
Yep. That is a really awesome name. And like you mentioned, it does star Nicolas Cage and Joel Kinnaman. After being forced to drive a mysterious passenger at gunpoint, a man finds himself in a high-stakes game of cat and mouse where it becomes clear that it's not everything is as it seems. So based on the synopsis, it offers this clear and concise, intriguing overview of what the movie setup and conflict actually is. However, we know that these miss the mark sometimes of these multi-layered things. So what can you tell us, Aaron, about the synopsis and what did it leave out, if you can?
Okay, well, primarily most of the movie is Joel Kinnaman as the driver and Nicolas Cage as the passenger. And that is literally what they're credited as. Although there are a couple names thrown about, but I don't want to get into that because there is an element of surprise and the screenplay is pretty layered. But it's primarily those two guys in a car or in a diner or on the road talking, fighting, arguing, and Nick Cage just going batshit crazy, right? Like that's, he loves to do it. I've never seen this guy turn in a half-assed performance and he doesn't start now. He's always just ready to go. The way that it plays out is one of those kinds of films without giving anything away. And I should say, like, Joel Kinnaman's character is a husband who has a young son, and his wife is in the hospital and she's ready to give birth. So he's actually on his way to the hospital to see the birth of his child when Nick Cage gets in his car. And it's full, I mean, when they say sympathy for the devil, Nick Cage's character is in full red dyed hair. I mean, it's like he is wearing a red suit. He just kind of looks like the devil. I'm not saying you can read into it or you can not read into it, or you can just watch the movie and see how it plays out and see if you change your mind. But yeah, so he's got a wild character. It's an intense movie that definitely has layers and it really plays out as it goes. It's fun. It's a fun, interesting flick. And it's one of those where once you get to the end, it's worth watching again to see if you see the movie a different way.
We've talked about Nicolas Cage's career over the last few years. And, you know, even in some of his movies that aren't the best movies, we still find the ability of enjoying him in general. I mm-hmm. know that you're not the biggest fan of Joel Kinnaman. Mm-mm. And nope. You find a lot of his performances to be bland at times. So considering this, does their collaboration in this movie give you something unique that you wouldn't get from any other pairing?
Joel Kinnaman is pretty much Joel Kinnaman. I don't really think there's a whole lot different there. I don't think he's stretching. He pretty much feels like a really reserved Rick Flag. And every other character I've seen him play. Now, when it comes to Nick Cage, I mean, you've seen Nick Cage, right? Like, he doesn't bore you.
Mm-hmm.
It's near impossible, I think, for Nicolas Cage to bore you. And he's got two kind of modes. One, very, very kind of relaxed, direct, more seething underneath his skin, kind of boiling tension. And then you've got just batshit crazy Nick Cage, where he's eating cockroaches and he's just, you know, slapping teenage girls on the ass and face off. There's like two brands. This is the latter. This is the face off Nick Cage. I mean, he's definitely just going buck wild, but there are moments of, how do I explain it without spoiling it? There are moments of depth and a deeper meaning to his character than it would seem. And there's actually, as the movie goes, I really became somewhat empathetic in many ways to this character, even though he's batshit nuts and shooting people at random.
Okay. All right. So we mentioned the director. Does the director's style and approach to this, is it evident? Does he have his own feel to it? Or is there any sort of things that showcase his unique filmmaking?
I mean, it feels very much, do you remember like 90s, late 90s, when Tarantino was kind of on the scene and everybody was kind of emulating that style? It feels kind of like a From Dusk Till Dawn style of road picture, the first half, not the second half. There's no vampires. It feels very much like that. It takes place in Vegas, so you've got the Vegas lights. It's got a very 90s feel to it, to me. I don't really think there's anything that stands out as, wow, this is a director to watch. It's more in the writing than it is the directing. It's more of a two-person indie film.
Okay. All right. And so if $10 is full price of admission, what do you give this?
$7. I really enjoyed it. Really did.
Nice.
Yeah. Nick Cage.
I'm looking forward to it.
Always fun to watch. Okay. Okay, Barbie, let's go party. Amanda, I hope you're still there. You're still hanging on.
I was going to do that, but John just stole it from me.
He sure did. So let's talk about Barbie. And Troy, I think, saw it too. John did not see it, so it'll just be us three. We're also going to discuss, something after the fact. But before we get into it, I just kind of want to mention this whole Barbenheimer. Is that correct? Barbenheimer?
Yes. Barbenheimer. Correct.
It honestly goes both ways. It's not just Barbenheimer. People also do Barbieheimer.
I know. I did it at the beginning, goddammit.
No, it's Barbenheimer, officially.
Barbie
across the board.
It's not a real word, Troy. There's no official shit.
Dude, so, there is merch, there is posters, there is 10-minute YouTube clips on why it exists and how it existed and the backstory. It has become its own thing on the internet like the Grimace Shake.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I just want to talk about it because I just had a weekend where it like brought in 162 million, something like that, and 350 million worldwide. Biggest debut of the year. I just want to point out Barbie beat Indiana Jones, Mission Impossible, fucking Guardians of the Galaxy. Barbie kicked everybody's ass. And Oppenheimer, I would argue, only succeeded. It had like an $80 million weekend. Only succeeded to that level because of the whole Barbieheimer and Barbenheimer thing. I don't think there's a chance that movie would have opened at that level because nobody was talking about it until that started.
Agreed.
Nobody. Nobody.
For sure.
So, I mean, honestly, I think Chris Nolan should be buying some Barbie dolls and just, you know, kissing them or something, getting weird with them. What do you make of this? I mean, social media just created a juggernaut. This is primarily social media, I would say. Great marketing, don't get me wrong, but social media kind of took this and ran with it and made it a thing to see both movies the same weekend.
Which just goes back to the studios going, oh, maybe we don't need people to promote stuff because we just have the fans promote it for us.
I mean, there's some truth there. There's some social marketing there. Was anybody surprised? And by the way, this goes back. Box office tracking has been bullshit all year. Stop putting so much faith in it. I'm tired of hearing people say, well, you know, there's forecast. It's going to make da-da-da-da. That hasn't been right yet. Well, yeah, it's been right several times. Only if you look at like when they check on Wednesday, the Wednesday before it opens. But all the box office tracking like weeks and weeks ahead of time has not been right yet. Barbie was like a $60 million opening. Then it was 70. Then it was 80. Then, hey, it might break 100 million. And then it does 160 million. Nobody had any freaking clue that that was going to do that well. Nobody had any clue that Oppenheimer was going to do as well as it did. This is a complete surprise. Why?
Well, so this is actually something that I put on my Twitter, but it's what's ironic and funny to me about all of this is everyone is so surprised. I'm not surprised in the least bit because I am fully cognizant and aware that women really push through, like, I think it's like up to 70, 80% of purchasing decisions. And that's why marketers try to advertise towards women because they know that women are going to be invested. And you give women products that they want to enjoy, like movies that they want to enjoy, they're going to get all of their girlfriends together and they're all going to go out to the movies. And exactly what I thought would happen, where it pretty much turned into like a night of Halloween where people are dressing up and going in costume, something we haven't seen in, I would argue, probably a decade and a half, where people are in herds coming out in costume for this one movie.
I would say since Endgame. I would say Endgame had that effect.
Wonder Woman.
Yeah, but I don't feel same extent. Like, I've not even like seen this. Men dressing up in pink. Yeah, no. Like, everyone is... They're not, it's not like they're just coming out in Barbie merchandise or like an actual costume, but they collectively came together and said, this movie represents women. Women are pink and we're going to come out and we're going to wear pink. And when women started to hear the messaging behind it, it's hard to not get that rally around something like that. That is so positive, but also very realistic. Like the message of the movie is not just, you know, girls are awesome or women are so cool, or, you know, it covers the gender dynamics between women and men. And in some ways it flips it on its axis. You know, it goes in the other direction where you're like, this is what it would be like in a reverse world where women are dominating and men are not. And they don't even know what voting rights and opportunity that they have. And I feel like that's so interesting to bring these elements to light in such a fun and explosive way. And it also explores the mental dynamics that women have to go through. I shouldn't even say have to go through, but women have been trained to go through in terms of not being enough, not being perfect, feeling like everything has to be in its right place, or you're going to lose job opportunities. You're going to lose a lot of things. Relationship opportunities, you're going to lose, you know, all sorts of things. And so it's like removing that idea around what Barbie has been stereotyped as representing for women and flipping it on its head and saying, no, this is really what Barbie's intention was supposed to be. And this is what Barbie has tried to represent, which is every single type of woman and career and opportunity that exists for women. Women can be anything they want. Yeah. And that's such a great message, not just for adults, but for young girls. Now, granted, I wouldn't encourage you to bring your littlest girls to go see this, because there's some adult nature there in some respects. But, you know, your preteens and up, I think, would be fine with this.
Yeah, so much for go woke, go broke. Huh? Yeah.
What a right?
dumbass saying. So the story is Barbie's having the time of her life, as always, while living in Barbie land, until one day she begins to contemplate death. This is something dolls don't do. So to right this wrong, she is told she must venture to the real world and find out the root of her angst, much to the dismay of Mattel execs and Ken, who tags along and finds himself changed as well. I'm not going to say any more on that. But it stars Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling, Kate McKinnon, Will Ferrell, Simu Liu, Issa Rae, and countless others. Amanda, you already talked about it very much. Who is this movie for? What did you think of this story and how they chose to take, because they could have went anywhere with Barbie. And they've tried to bring Barbie to the screen in multiple iterations, most famously with Amy Schumer at the helm. I'm glad that didn't happen because I don't think she's funny anymore. But who is this movie for exactly? What did you think of the story? And please feel free to woman-splain it. We deserve it.
This, you know, what's funny about this is I think a lot of people are anticipating that Barbie is made just for women and that it's this very feminist movie and it's so woke and all of this. Right. But there's something for everyone. There's something for people who are kind of like they don't fit in anywhere. Like there's a character who is like, I don't fit in Barbie land, but he probably also doesn't fit in the real world. And so he's kind of caught in between these two places. And I'm not going to I'll put my own opinion. I think that that's a good way to represent people who struggle with their gender identity. And you have this dynamic for women where it's like, you can do anything you want. You are beautiful. You are amazing. There's so much empowerment in this film. In the same respect, I think it also challenges women to not be too extreme in your feminism, in that you take away equity and equality for the men in the world too. And that, you know, everyone has a valid voice, and that things, you know, there's still a right and a wrong in the way of leading, which I think was great too. But what I enjoyed about it is that you get to see some things from the men's perspective in a movie that is so focused on women and women empowerment, and still taking that moment to recognize, like, you know, is this fair? Is this right? Is it, should it be now that we take complete control over everything as women because we were subject to not having choice and decisions for so long? So I have a lot of feelings about the messaging behind the movie, but I think if you just look at it as a fun movie experience, even if you take the messaging aside, it's a lot of fun. So then it's made for kids too, in that sense, where they can enjoy all the pops of color and the change of scenery and the back and forth between the worlds and exploring all of that. Like, it's cool.
Trey, what did you think about the story?
The story is absolutely fantastic. I think, and it's hard to like talk about the thing that was the most impactful to me without giving something away that I think is absolutely purely magical in the movie. But America Ferrera, I think, did an amazing job.
She really did.
In her character as a mother who has a daughter who played with Barbie herself, who works for Mattel. And the way she presents some of her, we'll call them rants, for lack of a better term, is just the exact thing that I think women deal with on a constant basis today. Not to cross promote, but there is a great website called fairplaylife.com. It's also a movie from Hello Sunshine. I think it's on Hulu. This book was written by Eve Rodsky, and I think it speaks to everything America Ferrera was talking about in her role in this, where women have to think about this and this and this and this. And it's not just men who go do option A, do option B, check off the list. They're thinking about all of the things that are ancillary around the things that have to get done, and how that's just exhausting for mothers, for people that want to be a working person and a mother, and not have to choose between a career and being a mother. I'm not a female, so I can't speak to it exactly, but I highly recommend men and women alike go check out this Fair Play book. It's game-changing and just deprograms a lot of what I think men don't even understand, which I think is what the story of Ken falls into, is that Ken doesn't understand like what he is without his person. Like he can't be a whole ass doll or human or whatever on his own, because it's always been Barbie and Ken. And I think sometimes men and husbands especially and dads especially fall into that. I try to be the working person, but I'm also the husband and the father. And I think both sides of the gender do get some play in this movie, which is great from Greta's perspective. I think what Greta did a really great job of in the movie, though, was
Greta Gerwig, who was
the director and writer. And she did a really great job, like bringing in groups of people that might want to find different things about the movie. So it kind of was a bummer that it was, I didn't see the trailer, so I was super excited when I saw the opening. But apparently the opening was the trailer for the movie. But there's an homage to 2001 A Space Odyssey. There's an homage to The Matrix.
That was great, the opening.
I mean, the minute I started seeing those things happening in the movie, I spent the entire movie looking for those Easter eggs. And that just made the movie that much more enjoyable to get me to the points of the movie that Greta was trying to push, which is more of the philosophical and the points of view. I also like the similarities with the Lego movie and going into the real world. And it just so happened that Will Ferrell was also the one that was the CEO bad guy-ish of the film. I could have done without Will Ferrell's character, to be honest. I thought he was kind of a boob in this movie. But I loved the whole Mattel concept and where it came from. But the real heart of the movie is the last moment you get before it goes into the actual final moment. And what that represents and what it's there. If you're a Barbie fan, you will completely understand. If you're not a Barbie fan, I highly recommend you go read up on it after the movie, because it also explains why the person that Amanda was talking about previously exists also. It's Greta did such a great job making sure that she was a fan of the property, the content, the company, and it just speaks volumes to how it presented on the screen. We were presented with two amazing people in film in our time with Greta and Nolan this weekend. And it was great watching both of them on the same day. I had a blast.
And Greta Gerwig directed it. She did Little Women and Lady Bird, but she also wrote it with her partner, Noah Baumbach. And, you know, she had a tough prospect with tying the toy land into the real world and bringing the company into it and kind of having that flow. Troy kind of talked to it, but Amanda, did it flow for you?
For the most part, I mean, it was a little strange for me to wrap my head around the dynamics of getting into a car and
a jet ski and a boat and a,
yeah.
and a bike. And
yeah.
a
bike. It reminded that actually reminded me of the travel in Elf. The movie
yes,
Elf.
Yes. I thought the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really cute. I don't know if that was an honest homage to it or what, but I thought that was really sweet. But that part, you know, just the logistics behind it, I feel like I was starting to get wrapped into, you know, how plausible would this be? Did they work out
how
the dynamics?
Plausible.
Right? But there was, because I was like, does the math check out in the way that they're promoting this to me? But then I got to a point where I was like, shut up. Like, just enjoy the movie. Stop thinking too much about it. You know, just take it for what it is. And I will say the only thing that I didn't enjoy is there are two musical sequences that I feel were mostly just a way to give a character screen time that felt like it was completely unnecessary or needed.
Maybe, but the Ken song that was the 80s ballad, I'm all
yeah.
in. I was all in.
It went on so long. I was like, another one?
It was funny when it was on the radio, and then when they did the whole sequence with the guitars, it was like this could have been about 20 minutes shorter.
Troy, I swear to God, I'm going to start
an hour and 45 minutes, and he's like, it's still too long.
I'm going to send you dick punches in the mail every time you say something's 20 minutes too short. That's just my new thing. I thought the story was very, very clever. It was very interesting. You know, like the last act really, really kind of. It got me to a different level than I was expecting from the movie, because I thought it was very fun, but it had an underlying current, but then it really started hitting me hard. And I will tell you, there's a speech that's given, and I won't say anything more about that, but you'll know it when you hear it. It's a great monologue. And my theater was full, which I haven't seen in forever. I think probably since Top Gun Maverick. I sent myself full theater. My entire theater was weeping. You could hear sobbing. You could hear just tears coming from every aisle.
I totally cried.
And, I was impressed, man. I was just really, really moved because, you know, I've seen this audience, these audience moments in Endgame, and I've seen audience moments in Spider-Man, all the stuff that appeals to me, right? So when there's these big fan moments, these big moments that hit you in the gut, it's because, you know, oh, I saw Toby again, or, you know, or, oh my God, not Tony Stark, you know, those kinds of things. But I never really, I guess, think of it from a woman's perspective that we've had Transformers and we've had G.I. Joe. We've had all these movies and women haven't had Barbie. And then there's this massive monologue and this massive film speaking to multiple generations of women, and they all get it. And maybe I don't get it, but it made me get it. Does that make sense?
I hope. Yeah, it does.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It was a beautiful moment. And it was just like those moments with Spider-Man and with Endgame that were for me, but it wasn't my moment. It was their moment, and I just got to witness it, which I thought was just phenomenal. Like, I really thought it was a phenomenal moment to take part in.
I absolutely loved seeing so many groups of girls, like, friends that were going out together, families with like multi-generation of women going out together, boyfriends going with their girlfriends. I'll be honest, my theater lobby looked like it was just a bunch of Taylor Swift fans, including men. But there was so much, there was like equal love. Like even the people who didn't really want to be there were excited by the time the movie was over. And they were there to like support the women in their lives who really wanted to go and dress up and do, you know, the whole nine yards or whatever. And to me, that was really cool because I always see not, and this isn't to hate on anything like male centered or focused, because most of those properties I enjoy probably more than most female properties. But for women to have that opportunity where like we're going out and we're seeing a big movie, you know, it's basically turned into a spectacle, and I'll participate and dress up with you in the same way that I think a lot of women have done to support their husbands or just like, you know, whatever. But when it's something that means something to someone to see those people go out and support their clan, I think is really sweet.
Very much so. So performances, look, most of the characters in here are just Barbies or Kens. And they're kind of just doing little bits. Troy already talked about America Ferrera. I will echo that. I will co-sign on that. She was wonderful. Her and her daughter in the movie were just fantastic to watch. But the movie belongs to Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie. And I don't know which one was better because they are wildly different performances. Like, wildly different. Ryan Gosling plays, I don't know what the hell Ken is, but I felt for Ken, and then I hated Ken, and then I love Ken, and then I want to be Ken. The Kenergy is real, is what I'm saying. What do you guys think? Who is your standout, Margot Robbie or Ryan Gosling?
This is easy for me. It's Margot Robbie for me. Ryan Gosling, I think, did a really great job of supporting Margot Robbie's performance in the film. Mm-hmm. But I think that because that was the way that he was written, Ken is literally, for about 97% of the movie, he is there to supplement Barbie in some capacity. That's the whole problem that he has, is that he is there as a means. Yeah, he is the love interest. He is the means for Barbie. And Barbie was like, you know, she has other things going on in her life. And Ken is the least of her problems right now until he becomes the biggest problem. And for me, that signifies he did his job wonderfully, but the movie still belongs to Margot Robbie. There's a scene, and I won't even talk about it, but there's a scene on a bench.
She has the
most incredible, I can't even say that it's just her facial expression. It's just her entire demeanor shifts into these different sets of emotions that you can feel so deeply in your core. And I think as a woman, like, you look at what happens in some of these situations and you're like, damn, I have always wanted to be that brave and say that thing. Or I have always wanted to, like, see that thing out in society. I think the other problem is women are often very mean to other women. And this movie is supporting those female relationships where it's like, dude, we are sticking together. We are women. We are killing this. Like, we are not enemies. And even if we don't agree or we don't get along, like, it doesn't matter. We still need to support one another. And if somebody gets lost, even if they're not being themselves, we need to be there and support them. And I feel like that message of friendship was also really, really cool.
And if it's the scene I'm thinking you're talking about on the bench, like, the studio was actually talking about cutting that scene. And Greta was like, hell
yep.
no.
Yep. Hell she said no. It was the heart of the movie. And I would totally agree.
Totally agree.
Oh, that was, I don't know about the heart of the movie, but it's definitely up there.
Yeah.
Just
that one out. That one scene spoke to exactly what they were trying to get across.
It did. And also the scene in where she approaches the girls at the school when she first meets the daughter and she's talking to her and she has to go through
the realization.
Oh my
God. That's so good.
Her performance, Margot Robbie's performance. Like, I feel like she's not getting enough credit for what she does in this, because Ryan Gosling is kind of like the more, and I just gave him, I wasn't saying he was my favorite performance, but he is like ridiculously over the top and absurd. And that's why I think he's getting so much attention. But she is not getting the attention she deserves, because I was amazed at what she does, because she basically goes from, you know, almost vapid at the beginning, right, to just running through this course of emotions and finding her own identity and who she is and understanding the reality of the real world. And also still being funny, still being dramatic, still being, you know, hitting every emotion as she went through this movie. I was extremely impressed with what she, because Ryan Gosling is this boob the whole movie, you know, and she is running through, he does go through a few emotions, but his are always heightened. She feels real, even though she's Barbie.
100%. Yeah. And that scene that you're mentioning is like, oh my God, it's such a elementary school, middle school experience that probably the majority of women have gone through, but to see the quote unquote picture perfect woman go through a not great experience and to see that she's also going through some of the pain that others have gone through, that maybe you always have those kind of concepts in your mind where you're like, oh, the pretty cheerleader, blonde girl, you know, basically Barbie, stereotypical Barbie, which is who Margot Robbie is. And you think of them and you're like, oh, they've never had to go through struggle in mm-hmm. some way or fashion. Even women think that about other women. And the reality is they absolutely do. They just have different experiences. They go through different struggles than others who are ugly go through. So I don't know. I really like the dynamic there. And it also just level sets, like, she has been so confident looking from above, not ever really touching her feet to the ground of what she thinks she's impacting, to realize that things didn't go the way that were planned. And I think that's also a really good takeaway. Like, if you can't step to the sidelines and just assume that everything is going perfectly and never come into that relationship or that situation and participate. Like, you have to engage with it. You have to still give it some TLC and make sure that it's going the way that you want it to, or your child or animal is growing the way you want them to, or whatever it may be. There's just a lot of really cool messages in the film.
You might have to get off your high horse and get your hands dirty.
Oh boy. Just you try. If you saw the movie, you get that joke. If you didn't see it, you want to punch Troy in the face anyway. All right. That dick punch is in the mail. So I also, special shout out to Kate McKinnon for making Weird cool again, by the way.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So $10 full price permission, what do you give Barbie? Amanda?
I give it $7. Yeah. Hold on. That feels rude. I think I'm going to give it 8. I can't let Ryan Gosling's couple moments ruin a great movie for me.
What can you speak to the couple moments that might have ruined?
I told you the musicals, the musical moments. Yeah. They just felt so out of place and forced. Gotcha. And okay, like a music video.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I was like, when is this gonna end? Which is funny because I love Ryan Gosling's La La Land. So you'd think I would enjoy him doing another performance, but no.
It was all the Kens dancing.
Even one Ken was enough.
Troy, what about you?
I mean, the message side tells me I want to give it a 9. The set design is amazing. I would give the set design a 9. There's some pacing things that I wasn't happy with. There was Will Ferrell, which I wasn't happy with. I was kind of like, if you're going to commit to the 2001 Space Odyssey and make the box a thing, then it should have been a box of Barbie landing on the ground. And then like they tear open the box or something with because the monolith was rectangular.
You're overthinking it, Troy. What's your score?
I'd give it an... I'm not going to let Will Ferrell ruin a movie for me. I'll give it an 8.
Yeah, I would give it an 8 too, but I agree. Will Ferrell came pretty close to being a problem,
I would say. For sure.
The whole sequence of that was a... It could have been something really amazing, and I think they screwed the pooch on that part.
Yeah, they missed the window. Okay, that's Barbie. One more question. John, you can come back for this if you would like to. Why are... In fact, we'll ask you, John, just to make sure you're still paying attention.
Uh-huh.
Why are so many men spending so much time trying to shit all over this movie? I mean, Ben Shapiro went and burned Barbies in a trash can as a stunt, which makes him sound like the biggest, whiniest man baby in the history of mankind. But why are guys wanting to shit all over this? Is it because they feel threatened because women have a movie that's empowering? Is that why?
Of course. I mean, it's the only reason why. There's no real good reason for guys to be wanting to shit on a movie. It's childish, it's insensitive, it's any of those, or shit on a movie specifically because it's catering to women. It's really just a childish impulse that, you know, that they're going through. I don't get it. I don't understand it. If I had a good reason, I'd go see Barbie, but I don't have a good reason to go see Barbie.
We just gave you 20 minutes worth of good reasons, jackass.
I wasn't listening.
Wow. Okay.
The only reason men shouldn't like this is if they're about to have a daughter and they want to paint their nursery pink and they couldn't find any pink paint because Greta Gerwig used all of it. That's the only reason men should be upset. Right.
There's no reason why any sort of men should be upset about any of this. This is just... It's just childish for the guys to be like, oh, I don't want to do this.
Okay.
The thing that we should talk about, though, since you brought up Ben Shapiro, I thought this was fascinating. They actually had someone pull up the electoral map and of where Oppenheimer trended better versus Barbie trending better. And it was interesting to see that Barbie equated to the red states and Oppenheimer equated to the blue states. And Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania were a push, which are typically the swing states in an election. So I don't know if that says anything, but the map, when it came out with how they did it, was like pretty, pretty, pretty funny, actually, when you think about it, because we all know that the SEC Southeast is definitely the stereotypical Barbie cheerleader country.
I will tell you, $162 million opening weekend, every freaking state was going to see it. Women all over the country. I saw pink all over the place. Everybody was wearing pink. So it's a massive hit. Women, men, a lot of people are loving it across the board.
Yeah. Everybody is.
Yeah.
The map was a comparison of Oppenheimer to Barbie for the Barbie.
I understand. It's a fun movie. I'm curious to see where it lands when all the box office is settled, but I'm glad it was such a massive success. And that's going to do it for this episode. So remember that the next time you head down to a theater or stream comfortably on your couch, but mostly you go to a theater because theaters are kicking ass right now. Buy popcorn.
And that's where the actors make money.
True. Buy popcorn.